Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning is United States v. Jenkins and others. Mr. Theis, you the first one up?
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, in a criminal case, the minimum that a defendant can expect in the United States District Court is that he have an even playing field. And what that means in legal terms is that the jurors only hear competent evidence, those facts which the rules of evidence, the well-established rules of evidence, allow them to hear. And they also are properly instructed on what the law is so that they can have a fair representation of the law presented to them so that they can make their decision based on what the law is. In this case, Your Honor, the jurors were denied both, and the defendants, therefore, did not receive a fair trial. Given what happened, given the evidence that the jurors received in this case, which they should not have received, and given the instructions which were given to them, which were not an even playing field, which were skewed toward one side, that is the government, it is not surprising that the jurors reached the conclusion they did when they made their finding in this case. I'd like to talk first, and I will devote most of my time to two areas of the brief that we filed with this court. And the first one is that I'd like to talk about the tape-recorded conversations and the implications of the Confrontation Clause with regard to that. While we did raise some issues in which we were critical of the trial judge's rulings with regard to some of the evidentiary issues and the instructions issue, I believe that in this area, the trial judge was actually focusing on the right area when the issue with regard to playing of the tapes came up, because she was concerned, as you may have seen in the record, about the unusual nature of what was done here. What was done is that the government played tape recordings without the participants in the tape, any participant in the tape recordings, testifying about those tape recordings. That is, specifically, these were wiretaps on the phone of a Kevin Reed. Mr. Reed did not testify, which makes this case a very unusual one in the trials in the district court.
But all you need to have the voices authenticated. You need to have the foundation laid for the tape recordings. And there was a lot of evidence Mr. Reed was part of this conspiracy.
That establishes the foundation part is one of the bases for introduction of tape. That is, they have to have a proper foundation.
And they laid a foundation here.
Well, we argued they did not, but even if you
well, what specific flaw in the foundational process are you focusing on?
There were suggestions made that the basis for identification of the voices, that the individuals who made those identifications did not have a sufficient basis to make that to reach that.
Well, that's a question of weight.
Yeah, that's my point is, well, doesn't that go to the weight, Mr. Theis, not admissibility? I mean, I understand that you would like to have a better foundation, and you'd like to have more in the foundation.
Actually, you'd like to have less, but that's neither here nor there.
Probably would have been a problem.
But it wasn't the minimal foundation made here, because there were witnesses who said they were familiar with the voices, and then they said that's who it is on the tape.
Well, I'm not disagreeing. I'm saying that we challenged that.
Mm-hmm.
My focus is not the foundation. We're not waiving that issue, or we're not withdrawing that issue. But I think you don't have to reach that, because what happened after the trial in this case is that the United States Supreme Court came down with the case of Crawford versus Washington, and that makes the foundation issue really moot, because the tape should not have been introduced because the defendants did not have a right to cross-examine the individuals, the conversations on the tape that Mr. Reed never testified.
This is a co-conspirator. It's not hearsay. You don't have a right to confront it. Even, you know what, the Supreme Court didn't abrogate that rule.
Well, I would not necessarily agree that they didn't abrogate it. They focused on, they didn't say what the what
statements of a co-conspirator made in progress of the thing and in furtherance of the conspiracy are admissible as against the principal defendant without any further cross-examination.
What I would suggest, Your Honor, is that we no longer have to focus, or we no longer should focus, only on traditional rules of evidence and hearsay rules, such as the co-conspirator statement. Now we have to focus, in addition, on the constitutional principle of the confrontation.
But what Judge Bauer is saying is Crawford doesn't address the co-conspirator situation, or, and actually a number of circuits since Crawford have reinforced exactly what Judge Bauer is saying. Statements by a co-conspirator are not considered the sort of testimonial evidence that Crawford was addressing. They're non-testimonial. They're just admissible. The Fifth Circuit said that in a number of cases. The Eighth Circuit has said that. It said Crawford doesn't change this rule.
That's the key, is it testimonial or not? And our position is, and this circuit has not ruled on this, but our position is that it is testimonial because the government argued about it argued as if it were introduced as statements of fact against the defendant. So in that sense, even though it's
statement of facts by the defendant through an agent, that's the program.
That's it.
Well,
yeah.
But,
and it is not hearsay by definition.
But
so if it's not hearsay and goes in for the truth of the matter contained in, you don't have to have cross-examination rights.
All right. Well, our position, Your Honor, is that focusing on whether it's hearsay or not is not the only analysis.
No other circuit has adopted your thinking or your rationale or come to that conclusion with respect to the applicability of Crawford.
Well,
and the dismantling of the rule. No other circuit has agreed with your position.
A couple things I want to say with regard to that. One is that most of the time you don't have the unusual situation that you have here, where you've got where the Kevin Reed participant, as in this case, does not testify in the case.
Co-conspirator statements go in constantly without the co-conspirator taking the stand or being anywhere near there.
Right.
On tape, off the tape, otherwise. It has nothing at all to do with what you're talking about.
Well, our position is that we do have a right
to confront. I understand your position.
Confront. The other one is, I would suggest, and again, I think the rehearing was denied just 8 days ago. There is a case on the Sixth Circuit that has some language that might support our position. It isn't, again, the exact same thing. That's Cromer, C-R-O-M-E-R. I have the site, but I did not do it as supplemental authority because I just found it, just came down. But I would just ask that there's some language in there that I would refer the court to that might support our position with regard to that.
Rebuttal time if you want to.
Right.
You can submit a letter after argument referring
would,
to
I'd
this
I'd like to do that if I could.
Case.
I can refer to it today, too. Judge, Your Honors, I would just also, I'd like to move on because I do think that an equally strong position is our argument with regard to the instructions, and I want to make sure that we focus on that as well, because I would also argue that the defendants were entitled to an instruction on their theory of the case. We submitted case law from this circuit saying that as to the area of multiple conspiracy and buyer and seller, the court rejected it, and that it was compounded. The problem was compounded by the additional fact that the court allowed in a non-pattern instruction that the government submitted on the issue, instructions 20 and 21. And I would ask Your Honor to review very carefully the multiple conspiracy instructions that we submitted and how we were denied our right to have the jury properly instructed on our theory of the case. My time is up unless the court has any other questions.
You actually have maybe 30 seconds, but we'll allow you to either save them or use them.
I will save them for the end, although I also did want to point out we've raised other issues as to the hearsay with regard to the testimony of Agent Humphrey on the count 10 issue.
Now you are finished a bit, but we know that you've briefed the other points. That's
Thank
fine.
You.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Willis.
Good morning, Your Honor. Standish Willis on behalf of Antoine Hill on appeal from a jury verdict in January. I want to focus on, one, clearing up some of the facts related to Mr. Hill's involvement or lack of involvement, and then I want to focus on our argument that the conspiracy that Mr. Hill allegedly was a part of was over by the time he became actively involved. Mr. Hill was charged in four counts in the indictment. One count was a count that was alleging a theft by Mr. Hill. We filed a motion to sever that count, and we argued that by alleging theft of drugs, when there were no other evidence of drugs involving Mr. Hill throughout this trial, and that's what's so strikingly different about these facts, Mr. Hill was never involved with distribution of drugs throughout this trial. No telephone calls suggested that. No undercover agents, none of that involving Mr. Hill.
But, of course, your argument here is a somewhat indirect one, because the jury obviously was paying attention to the evidence on the different counts, and it acquits Mr. Hill.
That's correct.
On this count that you wanted severed. So the best you can say is that the evidence that came in purportedly about this count tainted the rest of the trial. But there we're looking at the overall evidence, and is the evidence there to support the jury's
verdict?
And
that's part of what I want to say, Justice Woods, that it did taint. But in addition to that, one of the telephone counts had six telephone calls. Of the six, five of those calls had nothing to do with drugs. It had to do with activities involving Wendy Winnon. She was the woman who my client allegedly intimidated, starting on December 28th of 2000. There was one count that related to drugs. One phone call related to drugs. And as it turns out, that telephone conversation wasn't involving my client. It was involving his brother, Andre Hill. And so with that, as well as the introduction of evidence that the jury obviously decided wasn't substantial, we do think there was a taint because there was no other evidence that he was involved in any drugs at all.
But when you say not involved in drugs, you might not be focusing on quite what we need to focus on, because this was a conspiracy prosecution, and different people in conspiracies play different roles. Sometimes somebody's a lookout, somebody's
Absolutely.
An enforcer,
Absolutely.
Somebody's actually the procurer of the drugs or the seller, and the government's theory was Mr. Hill was essentially an enforcer, so maybe he wasn't talking
about drugs. Let me start focusing on that, and that's the important part of chronology. During the course of this conspiracy that allegedly started in 1996, the evidence was related to activities that occurred in year 2000 primarily, and ending really at the end of 2000. In August and September, I believe in September, Mr. Hill was released from jail, and there are telephone calls related to that. There was no involvement of Mr. Hill, really, with Mr. Reed during those 2 or 3 month periods until the drugs were seized on December 27th. Mr. Hill then comes in to assist Mr. Reed and finding and Wendy Winnon because she was a person who had drugs at her home. So our argument on the Gruenwald case is that the drug conspiracy ended on the 27th when the drugs were seized.
But the government takes issue with that, and there are actually quite a few cases that indicate that a conspiracy doesn't necessarily come to an end just because some of the drugs involved in the conspiracy are seized.
Absolutely. And I think the distinction between those cases and this is that there's evidence that the conspiracy came to an end. Mr. Reed talked on the phone, and on several phone calls, he talked about he was pulling up, he was leaving, in other words, he was getting out of there. That suggests to me that it ended. There was no other evidence after that that there was any continuing drug activities involving the co-conspirators in this case. So I think this distinguishes it in that there's evidence that it did in fact end. We're not just making an inference that it ended. It in fact ended. So if it did end under the Gruenwald case.
But then don't you have a problem with trying to conceal the activity? That's part of the conspiracy as well. When someone tries to protect someone or tries
Absolutely.
To hide, and so the government would argue that Hill helped Reed prepare to hide from the police. He collected drug proceeds. He made the arrangements for the escape. That's part and parcel of the conspiracy.
And what the Gruenwald case says about that, and I quote, acts of concealment done in furtherance of the main criminal objectives are part of the conspiracy. And then goes on to say, acts of concealment done after the central objectives have been attained. That is, a conspiracy has ended. That's not a part of the central conspiracy. That's a separate group of activities. And we're saying in this case, because there was evidence, Justice Breyer, to suggest that the conspiracy had ended. The drugs were confiscated by or seized by the government. Mr. Reed talked about leaving the jurisdiction. There was no other evidence that there was continuing drug activity. And then there was this concerted activity and all the phone calls to track down Wendy Winden to try to make sure she didn't come forward to testify. So we think that falls directly in line with the Grunewald case, because there's one conspiracy related to drug, it ended, and then there's another group of activities, you know, obviously another conspiracy. I also want to just to address, if I may, the Booker case as it relates to this. We filed in our supplemental reply that this case under the Palladino case is one of the cases that should be partially remanded to the district court judge. And more than that, there was evidence in the record by the trial judge that suggests that she had a great deal of reluctancy in sentencing Mr. Hill to 30 years. So we think this is an appropriate case to be partially remanded back to district court. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cook?
May it please the court, my name is Frank Cook, and I'm appointed counsel for Merlin Coleman on this case. So unlike my fellow attorneys here, I wasn't a participant in the trial and trying to shape any appellate issues at that level. I had to go through the transcript and see if anything stood out to me as a potential issue, and the one thing that did stand out to me had to do with the court's dealing with a statement by Mr. Coleman in response to what I would characterize as interrogation by an FBI agent named Zydron, after Mr. Coleman had asserted, apparently, his right to have counsel present during that interrogation or during his dealings with the police.
I thought there was some confusion about when Mr. Coleman did invoke his Miranda rights, whether it was before or after his very colorful and remark.
My impression, Your Honor, and from I guess kind of reading in between the lines in the record, is there was some reference to an FBI 302 that indicated that there were some preliminary discussions with Mr. Coleman, at which point where he initially said he was willing to talk with them. And then at some point, he indicated that he wanted his attorney present, and then it was at that juncture, I believe, the references to the 302 indicated that an assistant U.S. attorney was contacted and that they weren't able to provide him an attorney right at that point. And then I believe, if I understand the sequence of things at any rate, that is when the tapes were played in Mr. Coleman's presence. And Agent Zydron asked another officer there, or said something to the effect that that's him on the tapes. What do you think? And the other officer said, yeah, I've heard this tape 40 times, and I've heard 40 other tapes, and that's him.
But, you know, there are two things about this argument. I mean, I remember that sequence. One of them is that, you know, the implication is that, you know, Mr. Coleman almost should have been in solitary confinement while as soon as he invokes his Miranda rights, and the police can't talk about that. They certainly do reveal to him that there are tapes, but presumably he's been talking, and it's hard for me to see how his substantial rights have been affected by any of this, because if people can hear him talking and they hear the tapes, they can identify his voice. I mean, presumably anybody in this courtroom, after we leave, could identify our voices.
Your Honor, my impression from the Edwards decision and others is, and I believe from my dealings with police departments, too, that a lot of them are, once that request for counsel comes out, they do almost isolate them, or at least they get them out of that setting. And it's fine, you know, that they play the tapes and so on, but
Would your case be the same if they had simply played the tapes and had not had the conversation about whether the voices could be identified? Surely Coleman sitting there realizing that these tapes are there might have made the same remark.
That's possible. But in...
So how important is it that the police actually had their little exchange as opposed to simply playing the tapes in his hearing?
I would submit that either one, either approach, would be...
Well, how can you call merely playing the tapes interrogation? Miranda doesn't cover everything. It covers...
Well, actually, I was surprised, Your Honor, when I was putting this argument together, I went back and read Miranda for the first time in a long time, and I was interested in seeing all the things they laid out there as techniques of the day that they thought were coercive in nature. And one of the basic ones was that they get a person in isolation, which I believe Mr. Coleman clearly was here, and then they start presenting evidence of his guilt to him. They posit his guilt to him is how the Miranda court dealt with it. And I would submit that just playing the tape would have that effect too. But certainly the additional dog and pony show of exchanging between each other, certainly...
You consider that to be interrogation?
Yes. I think it conveyed...
You equate it with the Christian burial case, but it has some differences. There were no direct questions asked. There was no indication that he was going to suddenly blurt out and admit he did anything wrong. There was no setup in that direction. They just played it and let him hear it.
Well, the Innes case is a similar situation where they ask about they're transporting a guy.
But that's the Christian burial case.
Okay.
And that's entirely different. They said their function was they were trying to get him to respond that he had knew where the body was. It's a different program altogether. That's when all they wanted to do was to hear the tapes. Go listen. The tape is just as good with or without his acknowledgement and his statement.
Well, and I think that, the fact that they were playing it in his presence, true. But it does have a coercive effect, and I think it was demanding a reply from him. I think it's
there's a case that followed the Christian burial case. It was a taxi cab murder in New England. And the two officers were discussing the fact that there was a gun around. Neither one of them thought the guy being a hardened criminal would break down, as opposed to the juvenile that was involved in the Christian burial case. And
right.
Said the guy suddenly blurts out, yeah, he did it. But that's an actual byproduct of what they were talking about.
But
there's no Miranda problem.
In that case, they were saying, I believe the discussion between the officers was, I hope a kid doesn't find the gun.
That's correct.
And that's,
but in either event, neither one of them anticipated that the defendant would suddenly blurt out and say something detrimental to his own. Well,
but that, in that case, too, they weren't confronting him with evidence of his guilt. They were asking
a foregone conclusion. Confronting him with the evidence of his guilt is not interrogation at all.
Well, I think Miranda would suggest otherwise.
Oh, do you? Well, we read it differently, I suppose.
Well, that... from, as I said before, when I went through it and it was discussing the interrogation techniques of the day, one of the principal ones, and I think it is common in police interrogations, that they confront a suspect with the evidence of his guilt.
All right. I think your time is up, Mr.
Yeah.
Cook. We will see whether there's water under the bridge since then.
I just have one very quick question. You didn't raise any Booker issue, right?
No.
I just want to make sure. Okay. Thanks.
Mr. Mitchell?
Good morning, Your Honors. Gregory Mitchell on behalf of Kevin Reed. Your Honors, essentially the issue raised by Mr. Reed is really one issue, and I know I raised in the brief the Booker issues, and I think the status of Booker, the courts could evaluate here with respect to the supplemental brief, but the real question becomes whether or not at the end of the day when Mr. Reed is being sentenced, whether or not he was not entitled to some departure motion made by the government.
What's the virtue? I mean, if there's a limited Palladino remand in this case, what's the point of worrying about departures anymore? I mean, the sentencing guidelines are advisory. So when we think of what used to be thought of as departures below the range prescribed by the guidelines, we're really in a different world now, aren't we?
Yes, we are, Judge, and that's where Mr. Reed found himself. Again, now that Booker's been decided, but the question was, where was he at the time of the sentencing, and where was he at the time that he entered his guilty plea?
Well, but why does that matter? If you get a remand under Palladino, I would imagine one of the things under 3553A that you would be pointing out is the degree of Mr. Reed's cooperation. I don't know what the district court would think about it. I don't want to prejudge that. Surely that's a point.
Yes, it is, Judge, but it's unclear with Booker whether or not you still need a 5K1 to go below with respect the...
Well, if the whole guidelines are advisory, why would you need a 5K1 but to go below the
You would not,
guideline
Judge,
range?
And I believe there's a distinction between the circuits of how the actual Booker is going to be read. Is it going to be read as simply they're all advisory, or is it the guidelines as interpreted are presumptively reasonable, and thereby the court is thereby looking at what the guidelines would have been and can and still provide the same sentence again as being presumptively reasonable. The question.
Well, I guess I'm distinguishing between the guidelines being presumptively reasonable, which they may or may not be. I'm certainly familiar with the developments you're talking about, as opposed to departures from the guideline range, which have always been something that the judge has exercised some discretion about. Now, of course, in the 5K1 situation, the government began that process by making the motion. Other departures the judge could do without a government motion. But going beyond the guideline range is something different.
Yes, Judge. And that's where the issue is with respect to the appeal, is that whether or not in this particular case, at the time that he was sentenced, whether or not Mr. Reed should have been given a downward departure, whether or not the government made its motion or not, given the due process violation that's alleged because of cooperation agreement that he had made 2 years before.
But the court finds there's no agreement. The court, I mean, I don't see how, if you really want to stay inside this argument, how you can get beyond the finding that there was not the kind of oral agreement that you are arguing, that merely identifying Mr. Coleman as Didi was it, and he was allowed to become an unreliable witness by threatening to change his grand jury testimony and so forth.
Well, Judge, the response is twofold. First of all, the plea agreement that was tendered at the time that Mr. Reed was prepared to plead guilty indicated that the 50% departure and, in fact, the discussions as to what was the government was going to do based on what he had provided up to that point was reflected in what the plea was offered.
Right, but that's the plea agreement that doesn't happen. I mean, that's the problem with that. It's never finalized as an agreement, and the government always puts an out for itself in these agreements, basically saying, we're going to evaluate this all along, and Mr. Reed, for whatever reasons, turned himself into a witness they didn't think they could risk using.
And the question becomes, Judge, is whether or not there should be a distinction, and I couldn't find any in the cases that pointed out the clear distinction between a cooperating witness with respect to a plea agreement and a cooperating witness that provides performance. And what you have is, it's the best analogy I can draw is similar to like a Rule 35. If a defendant has already pled all the way through, but now he has information that can provide cooperation, that's separate than whatever he's done before. And what we're saying in this case, it's sort of factually in the reverse. There was something that the government knew after an extended evaluation that they had all the evidence they needed with respect to this case. What they didn't know was about Mr. Coleman or Didi. And at that point, Mr. Reed was confronted with providing that central piece of cooperation as the only way that they really needed him. As it turns out, Judge, that's exactly what happened. They didn't need him at trial.
They did or didn't. I mean, look, even reading the briefs of the other defendants, Mr. Reed's absence at the trial figures in some of your colleagues' arguments.
Yes, Judge, and I would say, according to the record, Mr. Reed, and I know because I represented, he was prepared to testify and was standing by through the entire trial until it was decided at the end of the day when the government rested that he wouldn't be called. And that was the whole issue, Judge. And the only question becomes is whether or not, after all of this goes through, Mr. Reed is given a plea agreement that has this cooperation part of it, continues to cooperate beyond that, is put on standby to testify, and then at the end of the day, not a single credit for substantial assistance to be provided at all by the court. And the judge says, well, without the government motion, we really can't do anything. And I think, Judge, that question raises the due process issue that's raised in the brief.
Okay.
I see my time, so thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll now hear from Mr. DeWald.
May it please the court, Ron DeWald on behalf of the United States. The evidence showed here that there was a single overall conspiracy. that Kevin Reed was the main distributor, that two of the suppliers were Jenkins and Coleman, and that Hill was the protector of that conspiracy. So the evidence showed that there was a single overall conspiracy, which means that the multiple...
Well, I just wanted you to address the point that was made by Mr. Willis, the fact, his position being that there was a central conspiracy and then there was a separate conspiracy to try to do the cover-up and the concealment.
It was all one particular conspiracy. As I believe you pointed out, was that the concealment after the seizure of the crack cocaine from Wendy Wenin's house, that concealment and furtherance of the conspiracy. And that all goes to show the proof of the one single overall conspiracy. The evidence, though, shows that the jury instruction itself for multiple conspiracies, that there wasn't any reason to give that instruction. Even if this court believes that some evidence showed that maybe there were smaller conspiracies, such as Jenkins conspired with Reed, or Coleman conspired with Reed in a separate conspiracy, or Reed conspired with Hill on its own, those are all individual subsets, entirely alleged in the single overall conspiracy. And therefore, even if this court believes that multiple conspiracies are proven, that there was still no need, there was no prejudice, there was no reason to give that multiple conspiracy instruction.
You know, Mr. DeWald, I mean, the government, this is an argument we see a lot, of course. You know, the government alleges a big conspiracy, and then the defendants come in and say, no, it was a bunch of little conspiracies. And we always say, well, as long as, you know, this in a sense collapses into a sufficiency of the evidence argument, because if the evidence is sufficient under the proper standard to show the overall conspiracy or the subsets, then you have all you need. And it really makes me wonder whether there is ever a situation in which you think it would be error to refuse a multiple conspiracy instruction. Is this just all a fiction?
Well, the facts in this particular case...
Katiakis would provide when?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The Katiakis case was the one that established precisely how you handle those things.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But in this particular case here, with the facts that were provided, is that there was overwhelming evidence of the single overall conspiracy.
But the government is willing to concede there can be multiple conspiracy cases in which it would be appropriate.
Absolutely. And in the Kodiakis case, as you pointed out.
Your position is that this isn't one of them.
Correct. Absolutely.
And your position, I think, further is that they're really rare. We just don't see too many of them.
And that's simply because when the government brings the case, in this particular case, it's alleged as the single overall conspiracy, which is what the evidence actually showed. Turning to the discussion of the tapes itself, the admission of the tapes, and I believe that the questions that were asked by this panel, government really has nothing further to add. They were all admitted as co-conspirator statements. There was a Santiago proffer that was filed with the court beforehand, and that is non-hearsay, and the confrontation clause and Crawford would not apply to that. With regards to the foundation, the government provided witnesses to show familiarity of the voices of the tapes to all the defendants, and there was proper foundation for all of it.
How much cross-examination was there of those witnesses? I mean, did somebody say, you know, are you really sure this voice you heard 4 years ago is the same voice? Or
there was cross-examination that was applied. I can't remember right off the bat whether or not it was...
You won't discuss the effectiveness of the cross-examination, I assume.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But as far as the...
My only point is there was, in terms of the weight of the evidence, as my colleagues were pointing out, there was an opportunity to put before the jury whatever it needed to decide how much weight to give those.
Correct, Your Honor. And there was cross-examination by all three defense counsel regarding the foundational matter. But it was properly admitted by the district court, and there was no error by the district court. Mr. Cook, Coleman's attorney, discussed the statements made by an agent about the out-of-court statements of another agent. After Mr. Coleman, the defendant Coleman, had invoked his right to counsel. And the way counsel has laid it out for the court, I believe, is absolutely correct, that the five-minute conversation took place. After the five-minute conversation, Mr. Coleman invoked his right to counsel. At that time, the agents listened to the tape and made certain conclusions, and that was done in front of Mr. Coleman. The issue, though...
Isn't that skating right on the margin? I mean, he has invoked his right to counsel, and there are actually Sixth Amendment dimensions to this as well as Fifth Amendment dimensions. So he blurts out the incriminating comment, which is pretty, you know, pretty conclusive that he realizes that it's his voice he's listening to, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The issue is that Coleman never filed a motion to suppress the statements. And not only did he never file the motion, the district court gave him an opportunity to file the motion and specifically asked him, are you seeking to suppress the statement? And his answer was, no, we're not going to file the motion. And he called it trial tactics, and he wanted to show the coercive nature of the interview. And he wanted that before the jury. It's a trial tactic, and it failed. I mean, it wasn't.
So you would say this is outright waiver, not just forfeiture,
correct.
A conscious choice not to file the motion.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And there was no sua sponte duty based in the district court that once that motion is not presented before it, that it would have the motion or have the duty to go ahead and to not only raise the motion, but then also have a hearing about it. So it is flat out waived and forfeit. District Court did not abuse its discretion when it denied Mr. Hill's motion to sever count for the indictment. And this was the theft from the Cole conspirator. And that it was properly joined, as we had discussed in our brief, that they were closely related offenses of the same and similar character, that they involved the same people, that it was the same time frame as the conspiracy, it involved the same drugs, it was cocaine. And there was no prejudice to Mr. Hill either. And as this court has just pointed out, was that they were given the separate consideration, jury instruction, and they were able to figure it out because they acquitted him on that count and they didn't penalize him by finding him guilty of all the counts. They were able to sift through the evidence and follow the separate considerations, and they properly acquitted. Mr. Hill was not prejudiced.
I suppose Mr. Hill's point, though, is even if they acquitted him on count four, was there evidence that came in as relevant to count four that could only have come in on count four that then might have led the jury inappropriately to think about that evidence on the other counts?
The evidence in and of itself, as far as the conspiracy, was still within the same time frame.
So you don't think there's any evidence that was unique to count four that came in?
There was, and actually the district court had discussed those things in sidebars and actually ended up telling the jury to discount one of the witnesses altogether. And the juries are instructed to follow the court's instructions, right, and didn't consider testimony from one of the witnesses. And as far as the second witness, the jury's verdict show and the separate consideration instruction that they followed those instructions and came to the appropriate conclusion. Now, as far as the sentencing issue of itself regarding Mr. Reed and Mr. Hill, the government stands by what was we wrote in our brief. However, Palladino, I suppose, has
changed the picture.
Well, yes.
Has disagreed with us. So,
don't go down that road.
No, I am not. I just saying that. But the district court indicated that, but for the guidelines, that both Mr. Reed and Mr. Hill might have been sentenced differently. Mm-hmm. Therefore, if this court's inclined, and I believe absolutely, Your Honor, and that's the limited remand at district court. The only thing the government's asking, though, is that when that limited remand goes back to Judge Bucklow, that this court instruct Judge Bucklow to only consider the evidence that was before Judge Bucklow at the time of sentencing, and not to consider anything in between. And that is really the central issue here, is that when this limited remand comes back for Mr. Reed and Mr. Hill, that the judge would be instructed as such. Now, as far as...
The instructions we're going to give the judge will be consistent with what we said in Palladino. If the judge indicates an interest in resentencing, though, the whole point of the resentencing is to open up the record to things that might not have been permissible to think about under the old regime.
But I believe this court also is, in the Palladino remand, is allowing the parties to actually contribute to the judge's decision about whether
or not. Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just asking that part of the the remand order, or the limited remand order, is that the issue should be limited to just what was at sentencing at the time.
The issues, or
we just leave it to the attention of the trial court, and you can holler about that if something goes wrong down there.
That sounds like a good idea as well. And I suppose it's all moot regarding the government's promises, or the alleged promises that was made to Reed. I believe the record is clear that district court did not err. The record shows that there was absolutely no promises made to Reed on behalf of the government. If the district court decides to downward depart on its own, now that the guidelines are no longer mandatory, that's a separate issue. But as far as the government's promise, the record is clear. There wasn't any made to the defendant, Reed. Mm-hmm. With that, I'd like to with all the rest of the issues, I'd like to stand on our brief, and I'm asking that this court affirm all the convictions for all the defendants, and as far as a limited remand for discuss the issue of sentencing with regards to Mr. Reed and Mr. Hill.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Willis has 2 minutes and 15 seconds, and Mr. Mitchell has 30 seconds.
All right.
My time is up, but I have that cited.
Sure. You can give us the cite.
389 Cal 3rd 662. Thank you.
389 Cal 3rd F3rd 662.
All right. Thank you.
Just let me first just address the Booker issue. to instruct Judge Bucklow to only consider matters that were before her at the time of sentencing would be a direct violation of Booker. So I think Mr. DeWall is asking this court to direct Judge Bucklow to violate Booker. Of course, she could consider everything Booker said she considered,
exactly.
And I would assume she would.
Absolutely.
Secondly, on count four, we firmly believe that by adding, and by the way, count four was not part of the original indictment. Count four became part of the superseding indictment about, I think, 2 or 3 weeks before we went to trial. And what count four did, and this is important, there were no counts that directly related Mr. Hill to direct involvement with drugs. Count four did. Count four did not further the conspiracy. There's no reason for it to be there. What was alleged in count four was that Mr. Hill basically tricked one of the drug dealers into giving him some drugs. He gets in his car and drives off without paying for the drugs. That had nothing to do with furthering the conspiracy. This was totally against the conspiracy. The conspiracy was to traffic drugs, not to steal drugs. And finally, getting back to the Grunewald criteria, and the assistant didn't address the issue of whether there was the drug conspiracy had ended or not. I suggested that there was evidence in the record that conspiracy had ended. That Mr. Reed said ended. He said he was leaving. He didn't address that. And I think the Grunewald case does address that. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much. Do you want to use your 30 seconds? All right. Well, thank you very much. We particularly thank counsel who accepted appointments from this court. It has assisted us very much. We thank the government as well, and we will take the case under advisement.